You are listening to the Change Society Show with host Pat Lyons. In today's episode, as the UK prepares to emerge from the shadows of lockdown, Pat Lyons catches up with Chief People Officer Paul Cutler on what is next for individuals and organisations. They discuss how the scale and simultaneous shock of the pandemic has levelled the playing field amongst organisations globally, but also why their return to work strategies are very different. Can organisations offer people the flexibility to manage how they work? Can you build a virtual culture? Does this help or hinder blue chip companies in the war for talent? They then dive into other aspects of the future of work, including Portfolio Plus, the value of leadership continuity while remaining flexible, and what the boardroom of the future will look like. All these answered, and plenty more, including why human capital is your biggest advantage in the world of open source tech. Hope you enjoy the show.
Mr. Paul Cutler, welcome to the Change Society Show. It's been a long time coming.
It has, Pat. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Have you been?
Yeah, all right. It's, strange times, isn't it? But important to keep your physical health, your mental health as a priority. So feeling good, and the sun's shining. Spring is on the verge of springing. So there's brighter times ahead, I think.
Yeah, I think we seem to be, fingers crossed, over the hump of this lockdown three, and weather saying 17 degrees on Sunday with some sunshine. The spring is coming.
Yeah.
Hopefully we've got through this difficult period, which is, yeah, everyone feel a bit better, I think, at the moment.
Exactly.
Good. So I remember meeting you in 2016, and I think it was a sunny day as well, wasn't it?
In that it was.
Waterloo. And we started talking about the future of work, and we started talking about workforce models. Of course, you're a well-known sort of CHRO and people leader in industry, and I've been recognised for workforce models, and of course I've got my Challenger business now, Challenger consulting business, and we've been threatening to have this conversation. So it's great to have you here, and I thought we might as well just dive into it and see how we get going, because it's very, very pertinent now to be having this conversation. So if we think about the frame for the conversation, let's call it future of work, 2020 decade.
Okay.
The backdrop of just coming through a pandemic, where the digitization of the workforce has been pushed forward to a number of exec groups across the whole FTSE landscape, which you're very familiar with. And I generally think that there's a real opportunity to usher in a new world of work. And I think that's going to be the theme today. So before we get into that, Paul, did you want to do a bit of an introduction on name, what you do, game, and maybe a bit of a claim to fame or an interesting fact for the listeners?
Sure thing. Wow, you put me on the spot there. So I'm Paul Cutler. My last role, Pat, I was the Chief People Officer at Travelex, the retail foreign exchange business. When we met, though, I think I was still working independently, and you and I were kicking around the ideas about the future of work. And, what's interesting to me is the topics that we were discussing then were a kind of a premonition for exactly the world that we've just lived through over the last year. And I think we're going to find, that we're still talking about the same things, but perhaps in an even more urgent way now than we were back then. But I digress. In terms of, interesting facts about me, here's a couple of left field ones. So I used to own a restaurant and nightclub in West London. That was part of my entrepreneurial stage in life, had an amazing
supper club.
That's right. It's called Supper Club. And for my sins, I've never quite let go of that entrepreneurial spirit. So my brother and I also now own and run a boutique hotel in Brazil. So maybe when the world opens up again, Pat, you can come pay us a visit.
Well, I always wanted to go to South America. It's the only continent I haven't been to.
You're missing out.
So look, let's get into it. So we had that conversation pre-pandemic 2016. We were talking about, a world of work we'd like to see. We were talking about some of the outdated working practices that we all know about. Pandemics come through. What are your reflections on this year and the opportunity for the future of work? If we frame it around the big reset with human capital, what are your sort of reflections on this year and the opportunities for this decade?
I think, my first reflection is there isn't that much that's new that's come about through the last year. It's been such a tremendous shock to the global economy and to the workforce. And yet we're still really talking about the same things that you and I were talking about 5 years ago, that actually right at the start of my career, I was even talking about, you know, flexible working, the role of technology, artificial intelligence, you know, robotic process. All of those topics are the kind of same things that we were talking about back then. I think what's changed is the simultaneous nature and the scaled nature of a global shock that has hit every economy in the world at exactly the same time. I think that has forced a level of dramatic change in mindset and also in approach to the way that we work. In a way that previously it was perhaps evolving, and there was, you know, a sense of who are the organizations that are the most forward thinking and that are the most adaptable and are dealing with this change, and who are the ones that aren't. Suddenly the playing field is just leveled and everyone has to get on their game or you know, risk going out of business. And of course, sadly, many have. But many others have decided to really shift and to adapt and to accelerate the path to change that they were already on. So, you know, looking back, what's been some of the biggest changes? Clearly, an aggressive move to remote working out of necessity, you know, not so much out of choice. And yet you look at it now and you say, well, where are we a year on? And you hear organizations like Unilever, the CEO, saying we will never go back to a 5 day working week in the office. And you know, that's the kind of thing you probably never would have heard a year or two ago. You would have heard more people talking about flexible working and the need for it, but not such stark, dramatic statements as that.
Do you believe him?
Yeah, I do. I do actually. I think that what's interesting is there are going to be, like anything, winners and losers in this game. And there are certain jobs, you know, if you work in a knowledge economy like FMCG, like Unilever, you probably can make statements like that and you can probably get away with it. But you know what? The people that work in their factories, they can't. So actually, typically, it's the higher paid knowledge workers that are the ones that are going to be able to adapt more easily to a world where remote working is more of a reality for the future. But it's actually the factory workers, the nurses, the delivery drivers, you know, people who typically occupy roles at the more blue collar end of the spectrum, who actually are going to be harder pressed to adapt to some of the changes that things like COVID have brought about. So you might well see an exacerbation of the kind of economic inequalities that we've already started to see in the world of work through some of this shift. And it's a company's responsibility to determine how they deal with that.
Having been very close to lots of FTSE organizations, you know, over all of my career, especially if we talk about the last year. So we've done, you know, everything from working with clients to help them transform, help them become digital first businesses, help them on the digitization of the workplace. We've been doing, I must have done 20 CXO mastermind groups with our CXO client base and senior associate base. We're talking to a lot of people all the time. What's clear is when you think about the last year, you've got the first and that honeymoon period is the wrong word, but you know what I mean? When it first happened, it was very new.
Yeah.
Everyone was, you know, a mixture of, you know, cautious, scared, didn't know what was going to go on with the pandemic, but, you know, actually was enjoying the fact that they were working from home and that they had that flexibility to work from home.
Yeah.
And I was hearing everything in the first part of that pandemic around, we are never going back into the office. You know, I was hearing things like, we're going to close down all of our estates around the UK and Europe. We're not going to pay that. You know, it was just, it was rampant. And I was there for a bit as well. I was thinking, do we need to have our immersion center in London Bridge? And maybe we can just do this remotely. And I see my kids all the time and then we got our freedoms back in the summer. And then, you know, the winter came and then we got the second and the sort of third wave or the start of the second wave. And then it came through. And now I'm hearing a lot more of, I cannot wait to get back to work. I'd love to go back. And look, okay, that's because it all feels very painful at the moment. And we've had kids being homeschooled and all different sort of permutations of what people are going through. But how do you see this settling once this, fingers crossed, starts to blow through and we get our freedoms back and people will have choice? How do you see this settling in the corporate world? Remote first, hybrid, back to work. How do you see that playing out?
I mean, hybrid for sure. I think it's a no-brainer. But, you know, the interesting word that you mentioned there in your second but last sentence was choice. I think ultimately it comes down to, can organisations offer their employees the flexibility to be able to manage how they work? And I think there's a number of forces at play here, Pat. You know, one of them is, as I mentioned earlier, what kind of role are you in, and does that role even allow you to operate flexibly? If you look at some work that McKinsey did, they said about 20% of the workforce, based on their analysis, will be able to work remotely 3 to 5 days a week. They also said about 50+% of the workforce will never be able to work remotely. So step one is, which job are you in? Do you have the ability to be able to manage your flexible working? I think then step two is, what is desirable? So even if you can work remotely all of the time, is that good for establishing corporate culture? Is it effective for building powerful relationships and for collaborating on projects together? Is it good for your employees and for your own mental health? What does that mean for how you bring yourself to work? Depending on the stage that you're at in your career, you know, for those of us that are a bit longer in the tooth, we probably already have relationships established. We know how to build trust and rapport. We have some set of skills and knowledge in our locker that we can bring to the table. What if you're a new hire? What if you have just started work and the only work that you've ever known has been through Zoom? You know, how do you effectively become a net contributor in that world? So I think necessarily the answer has to be a hybrid. I don't think we will ever get away from the importance of seeing the whites of the eyes together in a room, being able to, you know, kind of bounce off each other, build relationships, build understanding of common problems. And in that way, we're much more powerful at solving things together. Equally, I don't think we'll ever be tethered to a desk again. So it's, you know, finding the right balance. And some interesting questions for me that come for that is, how do you do that? How do you form collaboration hubs and give people the freedom? So if I want to work on a Monday night between 7 and 10 p.m. and on a Tuesday morning, and the person that I need to work with actually has a preference for working on Saturdays and Wednesdays, then how do we figure that out? There needs to be some degree of compromise and agreement.
Well, a few things I've just written down. Well, the word choice, right? I think the pandemic now, it's guilt-free choice to work from anywhere, not either just work from home, work from the business. Sometimes I've been when we were allowed during the summer, just going out and plonking myself in the park and doing some work and getting some, you know, just having that choice to work in the best environment I can work in. So I think that's a really important thing. But just, if you don't mind, I'd like to hypothesize a bit on, if we frame it as your background and my background. So your background, as you say, TravelX, you know, big well-known charities, you know, big FMCGs. Mm-hmm. I've always worked with big corporates. When you look at that, at least 500 staff, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, you know, enterprise, you know, sized organizations. What needs to change now? So if we think hybrid, so sometimes it's a bit of remote, sometimes it's a bit in the office, you've mentioned some things there. What do you see will need to adapt in terms of org design, the structure, you know, activity-based sort of management versus outcome, you know, that kind of stream of thinking? What do you see that will need to change for the hybrid approach to work?
I think that's an interesting question, and it goes way beyond just flex working. It's actually all about, you know, the future of work isn't just about do you sit on a chair at home or in the park or in the office. It's clearly much more than that. But let's start with that. I think, you know, big corporates need to think about what effective collaboration tools they can bring into play and what kind of cultural norms and rules they need to establish to allow effective collaboration irrespective of location. And many of those exist already, but you know, are they effective and do they work, and what's the best way to leverage those effectively? What does that mean for communication? You know, how do you as a leader tell a compelling story to your organization, set a vision for them, inspire them to take a certain direction when your workforce is so fragmented? It was much easier in the days when you just stood in front of a room of people and got them all together and then could have, you know, the corridor conversations by the water cooler afterwards. Where's the water cooler in a virtual world where actually everyone is spread all over the place? And what does that mean for org design? I mean, org design is probably the next step, you know, maybe the first step is just about how do we enable and encourage effective communication.
There's a whole thing here around, because naturally you're in a bit of a virtual silo when you're calling from your study or wherever you are into a group of, whether it's Zoom and say you've got 100 faces on there, there just is a bit of a natural silo, whichever way you look at it, because you don't have the human connection in a collaboration environment. You don't have the water cooler things. You don't have the let's go and grab a sandwich, let's go and get a drink after, you know, all of those things that just builds the emotional contract, builds the vibe in pre-pandemic the office or the vibe in the business. Now we're talking about post and the opportunity of distributed workforce, the opportunity of talent globally, which, you know, there's loads of opportunity. There's loads of opportunity if harnessed in the right way. But be interested to get your thoughts on how, you know, building a virtual culture to be as good as it is sometimes when you've got, you know, that culture you can build, you know, in person, and how that plays out in a hybrid world.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think culture is, it's such an amorphous concept, whether or not you're co-located. Even in an office, you know, it's the classic analogy of it's like trying to nail jelly to a wall. What is culture? It's a collection of artifacts, of rituals, of standard behaviors, of the kind of language that's used in an organization. Culture isn't unique either to an organization. You know, what you end up having very, very often is separate cultures within individual teams. If you think about the culture of, let me stereotype for a bit, the culture of IT versus the culture of HR versus the culture of marketing, I imagine that is already bringing up images or reference points for you in your own mind. So culture in of itself, even within the office, is an extremely hard thing to define and quite a difficult thing to control. Then when you add the virtual layer, it does create an additional barrier, because how do you build those cultures when you're not able to co-locate? And I think the answer is you build them exactly the same way as you would do in the office. And you do that by, you know, frequent communication. You do it by establishing things like team codes and knowing what it is that you stand for. You do it through recognition and role modeling of the kind of values and behaviors that you want to see. You do it through leadership by example from the top down. You do it through grassroots engagement from the bottom up, having virtual town halls and coffees and ensuring that there is open, clear, collaborative communication between everyone in your department, in your team, in your organization. The tools don't really change. The barriers probably do. And so the savvy leaders and the savvy organizations, the ones that manage to create effective cultures, will be the ones that do that despite those barriers and the ones that effectively engage across them. There are strong cultural markers, I think, that define the companies that will succeed in the future versus the ones of the past. And there's, you know, lots of interesting debate. Are we going to see more of the big corporate monoliths, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, that increasingly take over and establish their very clear, strong corporate cultures? Or are you going to see an increasing fragmentation of this rise of entrepreneurial spirit, of the tech startups that then kind of, you know, begin to solve a specific problem and then disband again. How do you develop culture when it's not within the four walls of your office anymore, or even within the four walls of your company, when actually the culture is across the permanent employees that you have, working with the fixed term contractors, working with the consultants, you know, working with a range of experts that swarm together to solve a problem and then disband again? What does that mean for culture? So I think we just need to become more sophisticated and more fluid in the way that we think about it.
That's a good point. So if you think, makes me think about the stuff that I saw, you know, wrong in the market, which gave me the guts and the impetus and the calling to set up Sullivan & Stanley was very much that, really, which was, again, if we just say it was pre-pandemic for this call, for this conversation, you know, workforce management done in the wrong way. So, you know, this incessant obsession with having to build massive permanent workforces to own the talent, yeah, whilst treating contractors like a commodity, whilst, you know, bringing in big consultancies to own all of the most complex stuff that your organization should be learning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Recruitment process outsourcers. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on. And I think most large businesses were probably thinking, you know, we're big corporates, we've got a big draw, you know, we've got a great training, we've got a great brand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that's been ripped up to shreds now. And I think the pandemic's exacerbated now, where you're thinking, actually, top talent want to be independent. Top talent want to be freelancers. Geographical boundaries are now breaking down. So people are like, you know, doing freelance digital marketing and working from Bali and all that kind of stuff, or yeah, they're setting up their own businesses. The big corporates don't have the draw that they once did. I'm not talking about Twitter and Google and stuff. I'm talking about the other blue chips. So the reality of the Fortunes and the FTSE. So what do you think needs to change with the you know, because most people who listen to this will be CXOs with transformational mandates of some description.
Yeah.
They will be in corporates majority. So it's an interesting question. When you look at the war for talent, the different generations coming together with different work preferences that will walk, that will vote with their feet,
yeah, in a
week or a month. What do you think that these corporates now need to do different? Now they've seen, you know, the digitization of the workplace. Now they realize that there is a real war for talent. What do you think they can do to compete with the Googles, to compete with the, you know, heavily funded fintechs in Canary Wharf and Manchester and Leeds, and, you know, the distributed teaming that's going on for brands God knows where they're allowing, yeah, people to work globally?
I think they have a choice to make. That to me is quite striking, actually. You know, if you look at the PwCs and McKinsey's, the Ernst & Young's, what they're saying about the future of work, there's an interesting characterization. So one of them is like yours, Pat, which is the world is fragmenting. There, you know, you can work from anywhere. The war for talent, these people are going to vote with their feet. They're going to be much more fluid and agile with where they go and work. The permanent employee is an anachronism. You know, that characterization. There's another as well. The other characterization is big corporate is king, that actually, as roles are continually eroded from the bottom, particularly from the bottom via technology that is taking jobs away, employees are going to be, there's going to be a world of haves and have nots. And there's going to be a selection of big corporates that are able to cherry pick the great people that they want and actually, through AI and through data, manage them a lot harder and a lot smarter, and, you know, extract every last bit of performance out of those people. And everyone else is going to be fighting for jobs and is going to be in a much more footloose, 0 hours contract kind of world that is, you know, less highly paid and less skilled. And that's quite a bleak outlook. So, you know, how do you square that circle? I think probably both of those are extreme characterizations. There's obviously a middle ground as well, right? Where, you know, you are the sort of enlightened CXO of the future who's thinking, well, I need to have some kind of mix in my employee mix. I need to have some people that are going to work for me permanently. And those are the real knowledge workers, the people that, you know, are indispensable, who cannot be replaced because of their intrinsic knowledge of my organization and their commitment to my brand and to our service and what we offer to our customers. And I want to nurture them, and I want to help them to retrain as technology disrupts their world. And I want to help them to grow, and I want to give them a brand that is green, that gives them a sense of purpose, that is sensitive to the challenges of the future. Because, you know, by 2025, 75% of the workforce globally is going to be millennials. And these are people that care about purpose, they care about climate change, they care about a whole different set of skills. And then at the same time, those people need to be able to attract the guns for hire who are going to come in to solve a particular problem, and then are happy to let them go off and do something else and come back. So, you know, how do you manage that as a CXO of those kind of companies? I think you need to do some quite detailed analysis of your business. You need to take control of the future trajectory of where technology is going to disrupt, and what kind of workforce mix you want to have, not just the hybrid of working from home or working remotely and working in the office, but also the kind of demographic profile, the sort of technical skills, your ability to retrain, what that means for your employer brand, the kind of people that you want to attract, how long you want them to work for you, and then to work with your people leaders, with your HR leaders, to define a strategy over the next 5 to 10 years that says, what kind of workforce do we want? How are we going to be structured? How are we going to be organized? What do we stand for? How do we attract them? How do we compete in terms of remuneration? What sorts of benefits do we want to make accessible to people? And I think there isn't a shortcut to that, really. It's you know, taking control of the future and some good hard planning.
There's so much gold in what you've just said there. I almost don't know what to pick. what I'm going to say is there's a couple of things that spring to mind. So, and this is music to my ears, right? When I first got into interim management, human capital was a valued word. Human resources was a word that everyone used. And, you know, I was invited into boards where people were really looking at how they can do proper workforce planning to get the best talent in to deliver an outcome that would benefit the business. And people took time doing it, you know. And over the years, as I think it was, do you know what it was? It was the credit crunch.
Mm.
I was at the cutting edge of recruitment then, interim management. And the minute the credit crunch hit, the banks start bringing in RPOs. That went through the FTSE. All of a sudden, human got taken out and resources. The human for me was taken out of resources. And what you're saying here is the corporates have still got a huge draw, but the ones that will win are the ones that bring human capital back to the fore, and how they'll be able to construct that in the right way to take advantage of what's happening in this decade.
I absolutely believe that in a world, particularly in a world of increasing product and technology parity, where you can't really differentiate yourself from the company next door based on the fact that you manufacture this thing in a slightly different way, or you have access to technology that they don't have. You know, in a world of open source and in a world of cloud-based technology where you don't have to build some big clunky on-premise ERP system in order to be able to run your business, what is your competitive advantage? It's your people. You know, of course I believe that, because that's the job that I do and that's the work that I'm in, and it's my passion. But I think it's harder and harder to argue against that. There was, I agree, you know, at the credit crunch time, there was a bit of a race to the bottom. And that won't ever go away. There's always going to be a need for efficiency, for being able to, you know, manage down your costs. And of course, human capital is a big part of your costs. But until organizations are able to leverage it as a competitive asset and as a differentiator, I don't think you're going to see much success between or difference between companies unless they're able to fully take advantage of that.
Yeah, we're totally aligned on that statement. Do you know what springs to mind to me when you're talking about that? And the thing you said earlier was, I got on very well with Mark Gallagher, who you might have seen us do some things with before. So he spoke any of our events, an ex-Formula One executive.
Yep.
He talks about, you know, the change and transformation that Formula One has gone through. It's now a data-driven business. And he talks about Red Bull, he talks about Mercedes, and it's a competitive asset. It's a competitive ecosystem where the permanent staff are their competitive advantage, that are innovating, that are, you know, using technology in the center, you know, giving them that core competitive edge. And then on the outside, they've got an ecosystem of contractors and consultancies, et cetera, but they're all one team, one badge with one winning goal. So if we look at the sort of the Formula One band here, you know, okay, yes, that is a competitive sport. Do you feel that is something that corporates could learn from, like wanting to win again? Because I feel like some corporates have just got this malaise where, you know, of course, they're there for profit and shareholder gains and stuff, but that sort of winning mentality and constructing human capital in the right way, and that, as you mentioned, allowing, you know, AI, data, technology to do the heavy lifting, they could get some stunning gains. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would. And it's interesting you mentioned Formula One. When I was working at GSK, we partnered with McLaren, and we actually did some work with them to come in and overhaul the analytics function within GSK and within the consumer healthcare division, and how the approaches that they took in Formula One, you know, particularly all around incremental gains. And, you know, you can look to other sports as well. Like if you think about cycling during the Olympics, you know, the absolute transformation that was achieved through just shaving off that 0.2 second from a slightly narrower saddle, or, you know, a different way of training, or whatever that might be, that then add up to competitive advantage. So I think there is a lot to learn from that. You know, the concept of winning is an interesting one. Where's the fire in the belly between different organizations, and what is it that inspires them? And, you know, some organizations and some people that work for those organizations will be inspired by wanting to be number one or wanting to get ahead. Others will be more inspired. You know, their win will be, what are we contributing to society? Do we have a sense of purpose? Do I have a connection with this brand that I work for? Do I feel good when I go down the pub, whenever I'm allowed to again, talking to my mates about this company that I work for and the great work that they do and how proud I am to do that? So tapping into the various different, you know, psychological profiles that you have of the people that work for you and work with you, I think it is going to be important for any company that's going to win in the future, whatever winning means.
Yeah. Very interesting. A couple of questions. When we're talking about, you know, winning in this decade, if you look at some of the real success stories that are out there at the moment, and look, they're obvious ones, right? But, you know, Tesla, we're looking at sort of Amazon, of course. You know, Jeff Bezos has been in the news a lot recently, stepping up to chairman. You look at, you know, some of the, you know, Formula One sort of brands that are doing well, so Red Bull, McLaren.
Yeah.
Long-term executive guidance and leadership versus short-term shareholder primacy pressures and the ever-changing executive wheelhouse that goes on in some footsies. Do you see there being more footsies starting to back long-term leadership teams, or do you still think that, because there's obviously benefits for that, as we know, and we can see that in real life today, but do you see the shareholder pressure type organizations in the FTSE 100 and 250 and the Fortune 100s and the Fortune 250, 500s, do you see that changing at all, or do you still think there's a long way to go around the three-year tenure of executive groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, it's a good question, actually, Pat, and one I kind of have to reflect on. Let me sort of think out loud a little bit. I think the kind of scaled organizations that you're talking about, for me, there is an importance in continuity of leadership, because if you're a super tanker, it just takes longer to turn. So I think you do need someone at the wheel who is going to be providing some continuity of direction and strategy, and you know, that doesn't mean that they're not agile, that doesn't mean that they're not able to adapt to what will be increasingly fast changing needs in the world, you know, this year being a phenomenal example of that. But I think that continuity of direction is quite important. versus the kind of organizations you didn't mention, you know, the startups, the smaller, perhaps more agile organizations with a much lower permanent employee footprint. They probably have a bit more ability to flex and to be a bit more nimble. And I think, but you know, I hear myself talk and I kind of want to contradict myself, because then you say, well, actually, if you are a startup that is trying to grow, then continuity of leadership is pretty important there too. So maybe I come full circle and say, you know, clearly you don't want to get stuck with the wrong leader, and clearly you need to bring diversity of thought and representation into your leadership team. But maybe I'm a bit old school in that way. I think that there is something to be said for having, you know, a steady hand at the lead.
Yeah. It's,
what do you think?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because what I think is very wasteful is when you see, and again, this is more in the older industrial sort of corporate setup, but you you know, what's the average tenure of a CEO these days? 18 months?
Yeah.
Average tenure of a CIO, 2.5 years. What's the average tenure of us? How can you actually transform a business with that churn?
Right.
Yeah, and that's what I think the problem is with change and transformation, especially the word transformation. People are just fatigued with that word. Yeah. And if you think about, you know, say you're a managerial level person, you know, you are core to the business. You've been there for 20 years. You know you want to do something else. You know you want to go, but you're paid quite well, and you know you're in, you know, your corpse in a rock and a hard place. You know there's fear of leaving. You're treated reasonably well. Every 2 years or 18 months or a year, there's another change program coming through.
Yeah.
Multiply that by 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. No wonder 84% of change programs fails, because people are just thinking, we'll just let this blow through, and subconsciously we'll reject it and be the frozen middle. And that's the bit I don't like. So, you know, there's certain instances where sometimes I think a regular change of leadership is probably quite a good thing, and a regular change of your workforce is quite a good thing to keep things fresh. Mm-hmm. Where the steady hand with someone who's got a long-term vision that can be backed, and sometimes there might be a profit warning or two.
Yeah.
And that might not be a bad thing.
Yeah,
that person might, you know, so it's a hard one to answer, because every organization is completely different, and the shape up of the city and the shape up of, you know, economics and finance, you know, it's not, and the pressures that everyone's facing at the moment, it's not conducive to some of the setups that, you know, Tesla and Google, you know, Google and others will have. It is just an interesting point around long-term versus short-term.
I think that's right. And I think, I guess where we land on that then is, it's never been more important to have the right leader.
Correct.
Just underscores the importance of brilliant leadership, and just never letting that be a compromise that any chairman or you know, any chair of any company is ever prepared to make a compromise on ensuring that they are getting the right talent. And what does the right talent mean? You know, that is probably the thing that changes more than necessarily the actual leader has to. You know, the right talent is someone who is future savvy and adaptable, and is able to continue to steer the ship through, you know, choppy and uncharted waters as they change, because the pace of external change is gonna continue to accelerate. So maybe the paradox is you want to keep consistency of leadership, but that person needs to, or those people, that group of people need to be flexible and enlightened enough to be able to alter course and to steer through, you know, through changing waters.
Yeah, it's not easy, that one, is it?
Not for the faint-hearted. And it's also interesting when you look at some of the literature around, you know, what that there's paradox throughout. It's sort of this challenge between big, like globalization and big corporates versus fragmentation between the individual and the collective. There's even a suggestion in from some quarters that talk about, are jobs for life going to come back? And that feels so counterintuitive, but you think, well, you know, if I am working for an organization that has really got control of its purpose, that knows what it can offer me as an employee, that is prepared to retrain me and invest in me and help me because it understands the competitive advantage of human capital, and that this is a place that I'm proud to work for, maybe I wouldn't leave. Maybe I'm not that kind of person that is just going to go after 18 months.
That's an interesting one, because I'm sure you won't mind me mentioning him, but have you come across Bjarte Bognes from the Beyond Budgeting Institute?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so a thought leader in Scandinavian sort of leadership models and management models, and Equinor is what the business is called now. And I've just finished my second book, which is about portfolio working.
Yeah.
And balanced, I obviously talk about people who want to leave the corporate world and become a portfolio executive. So, you know, many gigs, you know, it's kind of what's my interest point and what I love and I'm very passionate about. But the reality is that isn't for everyone, because school fees, risk tolerance, blah, blah, blah. It's just not for everyone. But there's the portfolio plus, which is you can have your main anchor gig, which is your HR leadership position for Travelex, just making up for. Mm-hmm. And then you can have your side hustles, which your Travelex, just mentioning it as an example, your host company allows, because they see the benefit of bringing diversity of thought. They see the benefit of your human capital being energized and trusted and, you know, allowed to go out for, you know, periods of time. So Bjarte Bognes is an example. He just says, I feel privileged because I've been able to work for the same company for 40 years where they've allowed me to bring my management principles about beyond budgeting to tell the world. So he's written books, he does consulting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he's still bringing that fresh thinking and at the same time, a massive advocate and brand for what a great progressive company is. And it's interesting you say that, because I'd love to see, you know, jobs for life. Does that come back? Oh, I doubt it. But it's an interesting, you know, that's the conundrum for HR leaders and any leaders. How can I make this such a brilliant place to work with such purpose and such variety that people don't want to leave? And even if they do leave, they've been there for a bit of period of time and they've added value. And that's where I think the thinking needs to be with progressive leaders and organizations.
I think that's super exciting, actually. Yeah, you know, it's interesting to see how those two concepts will play off. And I think in part, we've been stuck in a world, haven't we, that's a bit of a dichotomy. It's viewed as corporation versus employee, like that there is some kind of trade-off that needs to happen. If you look at the whole, you know, the sort of industrial history of how we've got to this point and the rise of the trade union movement and the protection of workers' rights and how that's been enshrined in laws versus the corporation that is kind of, you know, painted as this exploitative entity that is only interested in profit and only just wants to go out there and, you know, work the workers to the bone and sort of use them as disposable. And if they can replace them with technology, they will as soon as possible. And that just seems a bit antiquated and a bit old school. And no doubt there's some truth in that. And, you know, those two tensions still exist. Of course they do. But isn't the future one where actually the interests of the company and the interests of the worker, be that an employee or a you know, a freelancer, those need to align if there's going to be a sustainable win for both sides. And it can't really be a trade-off, particularly as, you know, the base economy of it all, the worker is also the person that buys the products and services that companies sell. So there has to be a mutual recognition that corporation, worker, customer, those three have to be, you know, equally valued and equally respected in whatever future of work we embark upon.
Gives me a great segue to ask you, we're going to go forward a bit, but wave your magic one time just to finish off, as I try and keep these to sort of 40, 50 minutes. Visualizing people are driving a car on a journey or in a gym or having a run or whatever. So looking to the future, I think it's a great segue. So you go into a new organization, Paul, and you've got this very progressive CEO. He offers you a wonderful opportunity to be the CHRO and gives you a magic wand to do whatever you want. So you can go in there and let's say it's standard sort of 2,000-3,000 person organization with all the things you'd expect in that type of organization, to bring it to a very progressive future of work type organization in a 3 to 5 year period. What's the kind of things that you would do, and what are the kind of things that you envision as a successful future of work in a corporate setting?
Cool, man, there's a question.
No, I'm just intrigued.
No,
top three things or something, but it's just, you know, I think we as leaders have an opportunity to inspire this type of change. So it's
yeah, you're right, and it's a great question and genuinely thought provoking. I think step one, before you even figure out what world you want to bring in, has to involve dialogue with leadership and with existing employees, and ideally with customers and with partners. You know, you want to cast the net wide in your diagnostic. So I would want to be spending a lot of time going and speaking to leaders to understand their vision for the organization, to understand what they're most proud of, about what products and services they offer and what it is that they stand for and what it is that they represent, and what kind of culture they want to build. And, you know, if they don't like the word culture, then what are the kind of values and behaviors that they want to see demonstrated in their people every day? Then I want to go and speak to the employees and ask them exactly those same questions. You know, why do you work here? What is it that excites you? What inspires you? Where do you see yourself in the future? And likewise with customers and partners, to try and get a very rich picture and understanding of what makes up the DNA of this organization. What makes people want to work here, want to buy services from us? What makes the leaders excited about the future? And that would give, I think, a bit of a blueprint okay, so who are we? What do we stand for? And where are we going? And then, you know, once you've done your diagnostic, obviously you need to do some design work. So then it comes to looking at your current state and saying, well, what do we have right now? You know, do our practices live up to the hype? I'm of the mindset that says you want your HR framework to be as light and, you know, minimal as possible. So you want to have a very light scaffolding that people can hang their reward frameworks from, that can hang their, you know, their performance management frameworks, their managerial development frameworks. All of that stuff should not be overbearing. It's the kind of thing that people need to use and need to have access to, but not to be so prescriptive that you then kind of squeeze any sort of cultural innovation or ingenuity or excitement out of your business. So the design work, I think, is from a minimalist perspective, in my views, to say, well, what do we want all of these tools and frameworks to look like, and how can we answer the question, what's the least that I need to do in order to get the outcome that I want? And then the final step is obviously to then implement and start to embed those. And that's where you start to bring out your talent programs, your employee value proposition and what you stand for, your purpose, some of the sort of cultural indicators, like what do we do around holiday? Do we have a fixed number of days, or do we trust our employees to go out and choose that themselves? Do we have flexibility around benefits? Do we have flexibility around where people work from? Do we want to have representative on our board, you know, across the breadth of the business? You know, as an aside, CEO pay in the UK has gone up nearly 1,000% over the last 3 decades, whereas average worker pay has gone up by 12%. So, you know, what kind of equality statement do we want to have in our organization? What kind of cultural indicators and markers do we want to stand for?
If you think BrewDog are killing it at the moment, aren't they, with their above the line approach to, you know, being a model organization? I think I particularly liked the recent blog that came out, 10 mistakes I've made as CEO, and I was thinking I've made one of those mistakes already, which made me laugh. But one of the things that he put in there, which I thought was really progressive, was there's only 7 pay grades difference between an entry level person, like you know, someone who comes in at, let's say, a certain position to the execs. So there's no ambiguity, just seven stages, and that's it, and it's all transparent. And I thought that was quite progressive to be really announcing that. And then, of course, really leading the way as a socially responsible business model.
Yeah. And
vibe internally and externally, doesn't it?
Completely. And there are some great examples out there. There really are. You know, I spoke to a CEO earlier this week, and he uttered words that I never thought I would hear, which is, I'm not really that interested in growth. I'm not interested in IPOing. I'm not looking for external investment. Actually, I want to leave behind some kind of legacy. I don't need to earn any more money. I've already earned the money that I need to. I want to be able to transfer the ownership of my business to the people that work for my company. And I want to make sure that the culture that we have is protected. And if we do grow, which they are, then how do I ensure that the culture and the way that we work in our business is sacrosanct over the sort of, the desire to just grow at the expense of everything that he's built. I find that admirable and a noble cause. And I hope that there'll be more and more CEOs like that, because I think those are the companies. If you look at the stats, the organizations with engaged employees deliver 21% more profitability than those that don't. And that's quite an astonishing number. And, you can look at that and go, cause or effect, is that the only thing that led to that? Maybe it's, a whole host of other things. But there is an interesting interplay between organizations that have people that care, that want to work there, they're excited to work there, that pull out that discretionary effort from their back pocket that everyone has, but not everyone uses. What is that difference?
You get the emotional contract and the purpose contract, as well as the business contract. It's the holy trinity of talent.
Totally. Perfectly summarized. That's right.
One last question. I mean, I could ask loads, but I've got one more, I promise. And I'm interested in this, and I'm interested in your view on this. Hold on a second, just popped up there. Boardroom of the future. So let's transport ourselves to 2030. Who should be on a board, and what should be what kind of roles do you see being on the board? Do you think it'll be the same as it is today, or do you think that will change?
Wow, that's another great question. One I don't have a prepared answer for, so I'll just kind of freewheel a bit. I mean, step one, it's almost insultingly obvious, but it has to be a diverse boardroom, and that is diversity in all aspects. It's diversity of gender, of age, of ethnicity, of sexuality. But more important than all of those, which frankly for me are process measures rather than outcome measures, is diversity of thought. You want to have a range of people on your board that truly reflect the employees of your organization and the customers of the products and services that you sell. It's shocking about how far we are from that very simple baseline expectation of the boardroom of the future. And it is shocking quite how long it takes to get there. And there are many excuses for it, but ultimately I think it's people in power protect their interests. And very often, even if it's, unwitting cognitive bias, people hire in their own image and promoting their own image. So that's the first thing about the boardroom of the future. The second, in terms of roles, we are seeing more and more roles like chief diversity officer, chief sustainability officer. And I think that's moving in the right direction. So I expect that there will be, for some organizations in the future, much more of a positive and deliberate focus on, are we a net contributor to the benefit of our community and our society and our planet? Or are we an organization that is taking out profit ahead of those longer term, implications? And I would like to be an optimist in this and say, I think those are the organizations that are going to be more successful in the future. I think the jury's out. I think there will continue to be successful organizations that are a lot more, narrow-minded and a lot more profit-oriented. But I think as the diverse workforce and, expectations of voters and society begin to shift, and they are, and that's clear, I think they will be progressively less and less tolerated. So I do think we'll start to see a shift. And I guess finally, you would want to see, what's the right way to get representation of all cross-section of your employees onto your board, so that it's not just a pale, male, stale, typically older generation of decision makers, so that the decision making can be a bit more enlightened. Does that mean giving seats on your board to Gen Z? Maybe. Or does it mean having some kind of forum through which you can gather and pass on and act on feedback that you get from your organization in a much more effective way? I think probably more likely, but either way, I think the need is going to be there.
Brilliant. That's a fantastic answer. Love it. But Paul, you're a top guy. I love it. Every time I talk to you, I think anyone who's listened to this could probably see that we had a lot more gas in the tank, but we're going to put a line somewhere. And in the show notes, what I do is I make sure I'll put a link to your LinkedIn, so anyone that's listening to this that wants to connect to you can click in and say hello. Final question, final question. What's next for you? What's on the horizon?
It's been quite enlivening for me, this conversation, Pat, because it's reassured me that for my own career, I'm kind of on the right track. You know, I left my last organization, and I think many people can relate. It's been a really tough year. It definitely took a toll on me, the kind of work that I was having to do, which in my world, unfortunately, has meant a lot of reductions in force. And that always comes at a personal cost. It's not the work that inspires me or excites me. I always do it with a heavy heart. And for me, I've decided that I want the next chapter of my story to be about growth, to be working either in or with an organization that is looking to, and you know, growth is a relative term. It doesn't have to mean just getting bigger in terms of numbers. It can mean, taking the organization to the next stage of its evolution. And that might well be many of the things that we've been talking about. You know, what is the future of work for that organization? How can it build an effective and inspired workforce? And how can it connect better with its customers and acquit its social responsibilities to them and to the world and to society at large? And 5, 6, 7 years ago, that would have been quite hard. Now, there are more and more organizations out there that are interesting and that are calling and, fulfill that potential. So that's going to be my next move. I haven't found it yet. I've been pretty selective on the kind of gigs that I've taken on. I've been doing some pro bono work in the meantime, but the future I hope will be, something, along the lines of our conversation today. That's what I hope for.
I don't doubt it. And I'll continue to follow your journey with interest, and post all of this nonsense, just go and grab a lunch and maybe a drink together.
I'd love that.
Paul, brilliant. Really pleased that you joined me on the show today, and I've absolutely loved every moment of it.
Likewise. Thanks a lot, Pat. Good to see
you. Thanks for listening to the Change Society podcast. Sullivan & Stanley is an award-winning specialist change consultancy that deploys expert teams to solve the challenges companies face when undertaking change. To find out more, please head over to our website, sullivanstanley.com.